The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Devorah Zack. Devorah is the CEO of Only Connect Consulting and a global keynote speaker. Her clients include the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the Smithsonian, Delta Airlines, Johns Hopkins, and Cornell University. She's been featured by the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, CNN, Fast Company, and CNBC. She's the best-selling author of Managing for People Who Hate to Manage and Single Tasking. She has just released the second edition of her book, Networking for People Who Hate Networking, a field guide for introverts, the overwhelmed, and the underconnected. Devorah Zack, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
In the introduction to your book, you talk about your early days in grad school at Cornell studying business, and you write, quote, "I now describe the experience of those first few weeks in business school as like trying to learn Latin and Greek, except I didn't know Greek either." And this is the kind of framing for your book. It's not that introverts can't network. It's just that they have to do it in their own language, right?
That's exactly right.
So talk to us a little bit about that. Like, when you know this because you are a sort of self-proclaimed introvert?
I am. I'm actually an off-the-chart introvert, which people don't realize when they don't know that really the true distinctions between introversion and extroversion. Introverts think to talk and extroverts talk to think. Introverts energize alone and extroverts energize with others. And extroverts go wide, they like a lot of action, a lot of activity, and introverts go deep, fewer stimuli, fewer people that are connected to them. And so those are the real differences, which is quite different than what the general society thinks of as introversion, like shy or somehow insecure or lower energy. None of those correlate whatsoever.
Yeah, and I thought there's so many like really nice little succinct sentences in this book, and here's one, quote, "Temperament indicates preference, not ability." That is a very big idea in a very few words.
Indeed. I'm glad you appreciate it.
Yeah.
It's true. It is very true, because introverts can absolutely, like myself, get up in front of a room, even be the center of attention at a party at times or whatever it is, but they do it by understanding themselves and working with instead of fighting against their natural temperament. So if I say I'm an introvert and I should learn to be more like an extrovert, that is never going to work. Introverts do not need to change who they are and do not need to be fixed in any way. So the idea is for introverts to accept who they are, to accept what they need to be energetic and to build connections, and then previously labeled liabilities can turn into their finest strengths, the fact that they think to talk and don't like being in huge groups, prefer one-on-one.
So I want to dig into some of these, you know, misconceptions and truisms, but before that, it's a book about networking, but we should also define what that is. What
you're
is
right,
networking,
you're right.
What isn't networking? So give us your best version of what is networking?
Well, the reason why networking is a four-letter word to so many people is because it also has a lot of misunderstandings around it. So people traditionally think of networking as being correlated with shameless self-promotion or somehow manipulating people. It's not that at all. Real networking is about building meaningful, mutually beneficial connections one person at a time. So it's really something about where you both can benefit, and it's about significant connections. It's about, like I said, I say connections, not collections.
Right.
So it's about how deep are the connections. So that's what real networking is building lasting relationships that have value and meaning to both participants or with a group of participants in those networks. So the issue is until the first edition of this book, of my book came out, all the advice for networking that I could find anyway was written for card carrying off the chart extroverts. So people who love to talk to strangers and who enjoy being in a room full of crowds spearing cheese, and that suits them. However, for introverts and what I could call centroverts, people more in the middle of the spectrum, that doesn't work for them. So they're attempting to follow advice that is not in sync with their natural personalities. So in my book, I customize networking approaches so that you can be who you are and be way more successful than trying to be someone you're not.
Yeah.
Follow rules that were never intended for you in the first place, like you said at the beginning, like Latin and Greek.
Yeah, and I know as a self-proclaimed extrovert, I really appreciated items in the book where I'm like, oh, I do that. I should actually be conscious about that when other people in the room, because the one thing the science tells us now is there, you know, just like there's no right brain or left brain, there's really no introvert, extrovert. It is on a spectrum. And in fact, that spectrum changes based on the context of the situation you're in, or how many people or how few people or where you are even, right?
Well, there's two different things in what you just said. One is what you called the spectrum. I reference typically as a continuum.
Yeah.
So you're right. There's not one, two types of people, the I's and the E's. Most of us are somewhere in the middle, with some kind of preference to a little bit towards one or the other, except for the strongest centroverts right in the middle. And so you're right. So it's not two types of people. It's really an infinite number of types of people. And we also have other aspects of our personality that we're not delving into today, but there's a lot going on inside our personalities. But at any rate, so we have these gradations of where people are on the continuum. That's a little different than the second thought you were sharing, which is that it depends on the time and the place. So there's a difference between what your temperament is and what your abilities are, and I call that flexing your style. And that you're still being authentic, but you're being flexible in how you communicate and interact with others to meet other people where they're at. So if I'm an introvert, it doesn't mean I'm less of an introvert if I'm having a great time at a party. It means that the reason why I can do that is probably because I energized before the party and worked with my natural temperament.
You know, it's interesting. You actually use, in the book, you talk about this idea of, you know, as there's a networking event and there's a lot of people, and for an introvert, you know, instead of thinking, oh, I'm going to meet all these people, really focus in on, you know, one person or two people. I do that. Although I'm an extrovert, I don't enjoy cocktail parties, and I don't enjoy small talk. What I do is enjoy finding someone and going deep. And I usually find that actually becomes someone that I maintain a relationship with beyond that particular event. Whereas the kind of events I'm at where everyone's just changing cards, you never talk to those people again.
Yeah, and that has to do with, and I know, I'm assuming you're going to ask me some questions about follow-up, so
yes, I am.
I'll save what I was about. I'll bite my tongue right now.
Okay.
But you're right. That's absolutely correct. And when we have these interactions, something to be cautious of is sometimes when we go to networking events or other events where the networking is a piece of it, if we meet someone that we connect to, we're like, oh, this is great, I'm going to go deep with this person, and then kind of almost be tempted to glom onto them because, oh, this is someone I really can relate to. Like, I want to spend the whole evening talking to them because it's a real connection. And so sometimes I caution my clients, if you love someone, set them free. That even if you have a real connection, is to not let the conversation go past its like natural point when it's at a networking function, particularly one of those where people are there to, you know, meet at least a couple of different people.
Okay, so a couple things that stuck out at me in the book. One thing you say is introverts don't do well with interruptions. I want you to talk about that because I think you're going to be talking to a lot of people who interrupt a lot of other people, and they need to realize why that is a bad thing.
Well, and the reason why it happens is because extroverts actually thrive on interruptions, especially when we're talking about stronger extroverts. By stronger, I mean that display more of the extroverted tendencies. So for an extrovert to interrupt another person, it's energizing, and they mean well. So what I sometimes tell my clients is that if an extrovert says to an introvert, hey, how are you doing, when the introvert's in the middle of something, what the introvert's really thinking is, I was doing great until you asked me how I was doing.
Yeah.
And now I'm pulled out of my flow. So that's true. And then also for introverts, there's two things they can do in the context of networking with interruptions. One is to accept that it might happen at an event and to try and just kind of prepare yourself mentally for that. and or to if you to go somewhere that's a little bit less crowded, less in the middle of things, maybe go out on the balcony with the person you want to talk to or sit off to the side so you aren't right in the middle of all the interruptions. But part of it is accepting that, you know, how do I work with anticipating these things to happen as they typically might happen at a networking function.
Yeah, and I there are well-meaning extroverts. I think I am one. But I think the other thing is it's like the world isn't built well for introverts. And I'm going to say that another way. The world isn't built well for people who want to think deeply about something. And, you know, so that interruption can sometimes really upset what is frankly a better way to truth or to a real thought out idea or to a response. And it feels like there's definitely a disadvantage for the introvert in that sense.
And I want to say, when you say well-meaning extroverts, part of it is well-meaning, and the other part is like yourself, you've learned about introvert temperaments, and you've learned how to calibrate how you interact with people. So that's part of it is self-awareness and intention, mm-hmm. and also educating ourselves about how different people really are different than we are. Some people say we're all basically the same, and I think that nothing could be further from the truth. People are really dramatically different from each other in terms of how they process the world, and a mistake we can fall into is when we compare our insides to other people's outsides. People are experiencing the same situation very differently from each other.
All right, and this is an interesting thing, too, because you've kind of tilted that way a few times in the conversation already. I want to talk about it because you write in the book that there's more to behavior than meets the eye. And this is a really, especially in the times we're living in, right, which is like judgment central about every tweet is suddenly your thesis for your life. And you go out of your way, and this is based on clearly study you've done around behavioral science and neuroscience and that, of talking about, I mean, this quote right here, judging others is a misguided waste of time. You know, we live in a world right now where that's seemingly everything that is what's going on. But you have, you know, you look at science and start telling us, no, it really is a waste of time.
That's correct. Because people's inner functionings are so different. So to be specific, let's take it to the office. And let's say I'm an introvert, you're an extrovert. And whenever I walk by the lunchroom, it seems like you're in there so much during the day talking to people that I feel like I'm doing all the real work and you're just schmoozing.
Yeah.
For an introvert, it would be draining to be talking to people all day. But for an extrovert, it energizes them to do it throughout the day and it makes them more productive. And then if you turn that around, maybe I'm an introvert and you're an extrovert who work in the same office and you walk by my office. And it seems like a lot of times when you walk by, I'm just staring out the window doing nothing. Now, for you, maybe that would be not productive, but an introvert might need that quiet downtime to process and be more productive. So in that those two examples, you can see that people really energize differently, and if we judge them based on our own reactions to that same situation, we're going to fall short at least half of the time.
Yeah, someone once put a similar framing around this as, like, when I'm running a red light, it's because I have an emergency. When you're running a red light, it's because you're an asshole.
That's kind of like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we don't know what the person, and you can, mm-hmm. you can see all these signs that point to it. It's almost like a Rashomon, right? Where it's like, oh no, if I just known what conversation you were having earlier. And then this,
I just want to jump in there to your point. It's not only about personality styles. It's about what happened in that day. It's about where they come from. It's about the stress they're under. So if you and I are in an elevator together and you're more senior than I am and you quote unquote ignore me because you're just focusing on reading a document that you need to deliver to someone, then for you, nothing happened. It was a non-event in the elevator. Mm-hmm. For me, I was dissed and you were just not paying attention to me and you don't care about me. And so again, if we can sort of, I give clients sometimes a Q-tip mm-hmm. as a reminder, and it's an acronym. It stands for quit taking it personally.
Yeah.
It's not always what we think is going on, what we perceive.
The other thing in the sort of behavior realm that you talk about is elasticity. And we had the scientist Leonard Mlodinow on this podcast to talk about his book, which is called Elastic Thinking. And because you have a background in the arts, I wanted to read you this quote. Quote, that the exercise of elastic thinking skills, such as idea generation, pattern recognition, divergent thinking, and imagination is inherently rewarding, is the reason people have always put energy into the arts, despite the lack of material reward for most. And that's true. I think the arts actually promote this way of sort of thinking and behaving in a more elastic manner.
Yeah, that's a beautiful quote. Yeah, and also, like, it reminds me of how people, especially in this day and age, unfortunately, aren't as eager to go outside and just take a walk without, you know, staring into their phones or just be around nature. And there have been a lot of studies lately that have shown that being outside in nature and non-distracted can really make a huge impact on your whole overall well-being.
I was just talking to a nurse the other day who visited a bunch of hospitals in Hawaii, and on one of the islands, it was a single floor, so every hospital room opened up to the outside. So they all had sort of this, and the studies they did was their rate of people recuperating was much, much greater than in traditional hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating.
So I took your temperament assessment.
Good for you.
So I was 30 extrovert and 6 introvert.
Wow.
So what does that,
look at that.
What's that tell us?
It means you have a strong preference for talking to think, that you know what you're thinking through words, through discussion, that you get re-energized by being around other people, as opposed to spending time by yourself, for the most part, and that it also means that you tend to like a lot of activity, a lot of stimuli, a lot going on, that you thrive on that. And because the reason I say those three areas is because you have a pretty strong preference for extroversion.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that you're not capable of engaging in any way that you deem important or worthwhile. It just means that that's your natural resting point.
Yep, it's true. That's all true. All right, another really interesting chapter deals with a lot of sort of social media and digital world that we live in. And you write, quote, "For introverts, keeping active online can present a necessary nuisance, weighing down their to-do list." My wife's a total introvert, and I can tell, like, social media can sometimes really screw her up in terms of her even just her regular day going forward.
I definitely can relate to your wife in that area for sure.
So what is it? What's it about social media that's you know, is it the same sort of interruption? It's just a digital form?
Sure, it could be many things. It could be the fact that it's an interruption, that it's a lot of activity, a lot of stimuli coming at you from the computer screen or your phone, but popping back and forth, and especially if you're an introvert who also, and there's a lot of different aspects, like I said, a personality who's also a feeler, then you feel like you don't want to not respond to people or hurt their feelings or not pay attention to what they said. So it can kind of feel like being on a treadmill just nonstop to catch up, and that's just with one piece of your day. So what I would recommend for introverts or anyone who feels overwhelmed is to just designate 2 or 3 times during the day that's for checking your messages or, you know, specifically focusing on those areas instead of letting it take over 24/7.
Yeah. You also introduced us to this a thing I had never heard about, which is Dunbar's number. Talk to us about what that is, because this is basically this, you know, a lot of people are like, hey, I've got, you know, 5,000 friends. No, you don't. I think this is the response.
Right, right. Well, this is a section of the book where we're talking about what does it mean to be a super connector? Mm-hmm. What is the true meaning of being a great connector? Is it numbers or is it depth? And it's not such an easy question to answer. There's no one correct answer to that. So there's actually been studies. Dunbar's number is kind of one of the more famous accepted numbers, which is that we have a very limited number of people that we can truly consider friends, we're truly connected to. And so when we have the claim that I have 500 plus friends on LinkedIn or Facebook, that it's just not accurate. And so you might have a big network in theory, but how close to you are to those people? How much will they rally for you? Are they truly friends? Do you know who most of them are? So it's kind of rethink what we consider being a great connector. What if I had a much smaller network, but when I made a request, you know, half of them responded at any given time because they really feel a sense of community with me. So just to think about what we mean by the word friend, for starters.
When I walked into WGN Studios, I stopped by my producer Elif's office that she shares with John Williams, who's a host here at WGN Radio, and they were looking at my wife's Twitter account when I went in, and Elif was like, well, I was just on yours, and you have like 3,000 followers or whatever. Your wife only has 500, but Stephen Colbert follows her, who is someone. And then John Williams is like, I think she wins, and I'm like, I think you're right, actually. just a funny sidebar. All right. You have a great twist here, and it's a twist on the golden rule. And what you say in the book is treat others how they want to be treated. And one of the things this tied into when I read that was we have a program that Second City does with the University of Chicago and their behavioral science group called the Second Science Project. And one of the studies that we got involved in was this idea around a thing called self-verification theory. And the idea in self-verification theory is that people don't necessarily want to be seen as their best selves or their smartest selves or their cutest selves. They want to be seen as they see themselves. That's the itch that they want to scratch. And I think that's sort of that is deeply what you're getting at, which is don't treat people as you think that. Find out what they want, which requires work, that requires asking questions, that requires going deeper.
It requires paying attention also.
Yes.
Really focusing on the person that you're with rather than thinking about the next thing that you're going to say. So really picking up on these. People send us out cues and clues about how they want to be treated and what matters to them constantly. We miss about 95% of them simply because we're not focused enough. So when we think about that people all would want to be treated the same way as ourselves, that we're going to fall short almost all the time. But if instead, like you were mentioning, the platinum rule, treat others how they want to be treated, then even though I may prefer that you run up to me and talk to me in the hallway and ask me something about my weekend and when all these other people milling around, that may work for some people, like an extrovert, but for an introvert, that would be feel almost disrespectful. And that's why there's so much confusion around the concept of respect, is because it's not an objective reality what's respectful. It's very different to different people. And that's why it's so important to really invest in getting to know how other people like to be treated.
Well, and this is when you look at improvising, the fact is when you are co-creating a scene on stage and there is no script, you have to be fiercely aware of what the person is saying to you all the way through the end of their sentence, because you are co-building this thing. So it's almost like a nudge situation that forces you into your best listening, into your best practices, your best participation, your clearest form of communication, which is why I think that's such, for someone like yourself who has studied improvisation, probably uses a lot of that stuff in your business work.
100%. So it's been so useful also in, when I teach classes and do seminars, to be aware of the energy in the room, of when there's subtle shifts in what people are focused on. And I know you're really gifted at that as well.
Okay. In a section here of questions that I was talking about solutions, you talk about negative self-talk and what the problem is with that. And this is under my heading of words actually matter, especially the words we tell ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So when people think about communicating, they think it is between two or more people. The first person we communicate with is ourselves. And as you know, in theater, there's the idea of subtext, what the character is thinking behind the script. And in daily life, it's kind of the reverse, that we have something that is a continual thought process that goes on in our heads, and then that impacts, like you said, the words we use with ourselves and others. So the idea isn't to we can't eliminate self-talk, and most of us can't eliminate all negative self-talk either. So you don't want to beat up on yourself for negative self-talk, because then it becomes a downward spiral for sure. Mm-hmm. So it's more just saying, recognizing when you do it, and then seeing how you can revise it. How can you, while still being aware of what objectively occurred out there in the world that you might be beating up on yourself for, how can you reframe it so that you can use it as a lesson to move forward and be more successful, as opposed to letting it drag you down.
Well, we just did a podcast interview with a Harvard professor, a terrific book on crisis management. And they talk about this idea of, like, it's the fight or flight idea of human beings. Mm-hmm. And they call it, you're going to the basement. But when this step happens, you got to go to the basement. And goes, sometimes you just need to count to 10. And sometimes you talk in the book about, like, a few deep breaths. That's actually a valid idea. You have to take a beat to get yourself out of that mindset. And then the real big thing here that you talk about, which I think is hugely important, is the idea of reframing. Can you reframe so that, your one idea that we often talk about is the idea of replacing blame with curiosity. Can you be curious as to why this person responded the way they do, as opposed to always being a blame motive?
Right, right. So I'm a certified practitioner in neurolinguistic programming, the cognitive science, including how we communicate with others and how we build rapport. And this idea, like you just said, of reframing stems, I'm sure it's in other sciences also, but has its roots in my work and from this NLP concept that we can shift how we experience things. And what you were just talking about is what we call a meta state, like the state above the state. So if my state is I'm so mad at myself that I blew it at this networking function, my meta state is kind of like the version of me that's kind of looking down on myself saying, okay, that's very interesting. So I see that you're upset. It's almost like talking to yourself through it to be more productive in how we experience the world and interact with others.
Yeah, because it's hard. I mean, and again, the digital age doesn't make it easier, because now we have all these other inputs coming at us left and right that are, you know, fighting for attention. And, you know, you write in the book that new behaviors are attempts to revise patterns. Also a really interesting improv concept, right? Because we're always trying to create these patterns to make sense of the world. And then sometimes we just live inside these patterns, even though they don't make sense. And it's hard. It's hard to change your behavior.
It is extremely difficult, because when we're behaving the way that we're used to, the neurotransmitter signals just fire almost automatically, and we don't have to put conscious effort into it at all, as opposed to creating a new behavior. It's like you're building new neurotransmitter pathways in your brain. So it's a lot of work. But the good news is that when you take action close to the point of inspiration, you're much more likely to follow through. So, for example, if you read a book like this one and you're inspired to do something to start shifting behaviors right away while you're still inspired in the moment. And don't overdo it. You don't want to try and change too many behaviors at once. Just start with one or two.
Okay. We're coming close to the end of the podcast, but you have like name tag strategy. I read a ton of business books. I have never seen someone go into like serious depth on how to make the name tag experience be one that is not, because it is. It is fraught with anxiety. When I see that I have to fill out my name tag, I do not like it. And so I want you to talk through your name tag tips, because I'm sure a ton of our listeners go to these conferences and have to deal with this.
Thank you so much for asking. I need another hour to discuss name tags. I'm obsessed.
Yes, separate episode.
My editor actually cut like a page out because there were so many tips. So there's some name tag strategies are for people who are running the events, and some are for people that are attending the events. So let's say your name tag is on a cord that goes around your neck. What are those called? Lanyards?
Lanyards, yep.
Right. Oh, I got it right. So and then they flip around a lot, so people often can't see your name. So one tip is to have your name on both sides of the card in there.
Super smart.
So that when it flips, it goes on both sides. Also, if you're seated at events, pull it up higher, because most name tags are going to be below eye level.
Also nice.
If you're filling out a name tag at an event, you want to write a large first name, and if they request something else, that's fine, but make it visible and simple. And what are your favorite tips from the book? I could, like I said, I could go on all day about name tags.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was premium content because, and I like the large first name, small, you know, last name, because this is the thing. And you find yourself like embarrassingly looking for someone's name, and then you can't quite read it because it's not, you know, and that's all you want is like, I just need something. I got to know what to call you. Oh, and that was the other thing that was really interesting, because you put in the book separate section, but you talked about the importance of learning names. And we had on a social scientist, Dolly Chug, who talked about how do you remember that did you watch Key and Peele?
Yeah, I did.
All right. You know where I'm going with this. The scene where Keegan is the, you know, inner city substitute teacher in a white school. And he comes from an inner city school and he can't pronounce any of the white kids' names.
I didn't see that one, but it sounds really funny.
It's very funny. But this is a real thing, especially in D&I and diversity and inclusion, is if you can't take the time to learn someone's name because it's too difficult to you, what is that saying about your ability to talk to someone who doesn't look like you?
Well, like, you know, in the book, there's a section that teaches strategies, because you might be sold on the idea that it's important but not know how.
Right.
So there's different strategies that work for different people, so people can search for what strategy suits their own learning style. And also, what we can do is take responsibility to help other people learn our names. So when I'm working with clients, I'll help them brainstorm ways that, how can you make sure I remember your name? So it's not all, it's not a one-way street. So for me, I have an unusual name for, like, our culture, so I'll spell it for people, I'll assume they've forgotten it, and so yeah. I'll reintroduce myself a few times. I'll keep the name tag on longer than most people.
Mm-hmm.
So we can people can think of, like, an association or a rhyme with their name. So really focus on how you can help other people learn your name to start with. That's a recommendation I have.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you for your yes and story in a second, but first, you have this section on saying no, which is great, and it's very aligned to yes and, because what you're essentially talking about is approaching these conversations with a yes mindset, but you don't have to surrender your agency. When we talk about yes and, your and can build on an idea with your unique contribution. So it's more of sort of entering into it sort of with a positive inclination, but you don't have to give up agency. And I think that's a popular misunderstanding of yes and, that, you know, well, if this guy says I gotta jump off a cliff, I have to jump off a cliff. That's not what we're saying in improvisation, and that's not what you're saying when you talk about that section on saying no.
That's an important distinction you just made. Thanks. Yeah. So if we're at a conference together and the extroverts are all excited about going out for a 3-hour steak dinner with 20 people, and you're an introvert and you want to really just have downtime, I call it I time, then how do you say no gracefully and not kind of get pushed into being in a situation that doesn't serve you? So you're right. So no can be kind of a yes to yourself, yes to your energy.
Yeah, yeah. Just like in improv, you know, you learn about yes and, but like any experienced improviser is not saying the words yes and on stage.
Well, maybe in some skits.
Maybe in some, yeah, but not most. All right. So speaking of, we ask every guest on our podcast to tell us a yes and story, a time in their life or at work when they normally would have said no, but instead said yes and. Do you have one of those for us?
I have a million of them, but I'll tell you one.
Great.
So, as we've discussed extensively in this conversation, I'm an introvert, and I was taking the train from New York back to D.C., where I'm headquartered, and all I wanted to do was to have a quiet time. I did not want to talk to anyone. I just needed to re-energize. And I said to myself, as I sat down next to a seatmate, I said, Devora, you would tell your clients and you tell your readers that they should at least talk to this person for 5 minutes to make that connection. And I forced myself. I wanted to say no, and I said yes, and so I struck up a conversation reluctantly. Long story short, we completely hit it off. We became long-lasting friends. He ended up hiring me for a staff retreat. We've worked together, and we had so much fun on the train also. So and the main thing to me was that from the retreat that we really helped a lot of people with improving communication and personality styles, and I thought, wow, all this good came because I said yes and I did a little bit of flexing my style.
I love it. The book is called Networking for People Who Hate Networking. Devora Sack, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. I'm thinking this must not be where we belong. And the world split in two from the throng of every living soul, screaming at the top of their lungs, saying this is my.
survives.
Survive.